everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk, and very pleased to introduce to you today's guest, Dr. Ann Kaiser-Stearns, who is the author of Redefining Aging, A Caregiver's Guide to Living Your Best Life. Dr. Kaiser-Stearns is a professor of behavioral science at the Community College of Baltimore County in Maryland. She has received Excellence in Teaching Awards from the Maryland Psychological Association, Johns Hopkins University, and Loyola University in Maryland. Dr. Kaiser-Stearns, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you. So nice to be with you, Dr. Brewer.
For years and years, we've been hearing about the power of positive thinking, and a lot of people were saying, yeah, right. But what you're saying is that there is hardcore research-based evidence that says that the way that you think about yourself and your life can have either a positive or a negative effect on your well-being and your longevity.
Yes. Well, you know, ageism is a lot like racism and sexism and homophobia and Islamophobia. There are a lot of stereotypical ideas out there. And why it's called stereotype threat is the danger is that we buy into the stereotype. I was struck to see in a research article in a psychological journal recently that if you are a bright black kid and you have a white teacher, you are three times less likely to be identified as gifted. And the tragedy is, depending on how young that kid is, he may not identify himself as needing an accelerated math program and understanding that he has those gifts. Well, the same thing is true relative to age. There are advertisements for catheters and chairlifts, and there are writhing women on the floor screaming, you know, help, help, I need a, you know, one of those medic alerts. And there's all these stereotypical messages out there. And if we buy into them, the threat is that we will have poorer memory. We won't hear as well. We'll complain about our aches and pains more. We will age prematurely, literally. We'll buy into that threat and fulfill the prophecy.
The idea of shifting how you think and the power of the impact of that on not only how you feel physically, but as you say, also how you feel emotionally. And again, I have to say it again, your longevity, that's powerful information.
Yes, you know, I really believe we do have a choice in how we respond to the things that happen to us. Yes, it's not a level playing field, and more bad things happen to some of us than to others of us. But there's also the reminder of many people who've gone before us that choice. We have a choice in how we respond. I was influenced by Viktor Frankl. I remember reading Man's Search for Meaning as a 19-year-old in college. And here was a Holocaust survivor, a physician, who lost his pregnant wife and his parents and all his loved ones killed by the Nazis, and he survived a concentration camp. And he said, you know, the one thing they cannot take from you is your ability to choose how you will respond. Well, if a Holocaust survivor could say that, I can't imagine that I can't say that, or someone who's listening today can't still find a way to say that, no matter how difficult are the burdens they're carrying.
Let's back up for a second. We're talking about your book, which is entitled Redefining Aging, A Caregiver's Guide to Living Your Best Life. So let's identify what exactly we're talking about when we say aging. What age range constitutes being older?
Yes, my book, Redefining Aging, is published by Johns Hopkins University Press. So I had the responsibility of bringing my very best scholarship to this book. And I read 525 research articles, and I had a look at about two dozen books. We have evidence that shows, for instance, Becca Levy, who is a professor in the School of Public Health at Yale, she's done these magnificent longitudinal studies studying for 30 years stereotypical perspectives on aging. And she has found that if we literally have harder hearing, we literally have impaired memories, we literally age more rapidly when we have those negative expectations. And again, that's evidence-based research that has found those things.
The subtitle of your book is A Caregiver's Guide to Living Your Best Life. And you make the observation that 75% of caregivers are in fact women. Is there a double-edged sword to being a caregiver?
Well, absolutely. One out of four Americans is a caregiver to an older adult. And one of the things we know is that there is nothing really more stressful than 24/7 caring for a person, especially if that person has Alzheimer's or has had multiple strokes or has another form of dementia. And it is so important. You know, as psychologists, it's our job to help people take care of themselves. And it's crucial that those caregivers get support. Reach out to memory care centers. Reach out to other family members. Find ways to get their exercise. Find ways to get respite, because it's a very tough job, and it can be a burden to care for an elderly loved one, and you've just got to take care of yourself.
All right, so you're speaking to the importance of caretakers taking care of themselves. But again, for so many people, the idea of reaching out for help in the caregiving process is really something of a no-no. The sense is that as a caregiver, you're supposed to work yourself sometimes literally to the bone if you are truly being a loving, devoted caregiver. What's your thought about that?
I like to say, as you expect to experience an experience, so you experience that experience. So we have to be careful. What is it I'm expecting? You will never hear me say, I'm having a senior moment. I will not complain if my knees hurt or if I feel a little stiff, because lots of 20-year-olds feel a little stiff when they get off the tennis court, too. Everybody leaves the kitchen and goes to the bedroom at some time or another and says, what did I come here for? And everybody has trouble remembering names from time to time. And it's so important. You know, the research shows that people who don't buy into a negative stereotype but have a positive idea and stereotype of aging live 7.5 years longer. That's powerful.
As I look at the list of resources that you do provide in Redefining Aging, the list seems to be so vast and so comprehensive that it seems to me that anyone of any age could benefit from looking at that list of resources actually right now, today, because it is so varied and wide in its scope. Too many times I think that people who are in the process of caregiving will wait until the very last possible moment, until the situation has potentially reached critical mass before reaching out. And a wonderful way to reduce your own stress is to really to have some sense of the resources that are available to you right day, right now, today.
Well, here's the thing. I teach developmental psychology to college students, and the textbooks now divide aging and late adult life into young old age and old age, because 60 is the new 50 and 70 is the new 60. So here's what they're saying. Young old age is being defined as from 65 to 80 or even 85, and old age is being defined as 80 or 85 to 100 and beyond. Because we're living healthier, more vital lives, we're more active socially, we're more active physically, We have medications like high blood pressure medicine and ways to try to avoid diabetes and the like. So we're redefining what old age is.
You know, I think that a lot of us really don't think about the person who still remains there inside of whatever the experience is. But the other thing I think that we have to address is the fact that so many people believe that simply by virtue of being older, simply by virtue of going through the process of aging, you're going to experience dementia, you're going to lose your hearing, you're going to experience depression.
Yes, because if you look at the research and you look at 90-year-olds, there is still only about a 50% chance that at the age of 90 we will have dementia. And if you see memory problems before the age of 80, that is not normal aging. That bespeaks some kind of disorder or disease. Many of those things can be treated. Lyme disease can mask as dementia. Depression can mask as dementia. Many other things, high-level stress. It's so important to get medical care, and it's important to not buy into those ideas of inevitability. One of the things we know, for instance, is that between the ages of 20 and 75, IQ stays the same. And if you look at people who have active lives and stay physically active, you can significantly reduce your risk of Alzheimer's disease by your lifestyle choices, by getting medical treatment, by avoiding diabetes, by getting treatment or avoiding sleep apnea, by getting treatment or avoiding obesity, by quitting smoking. All of those things would cut your risk of dementia in half.
When you use the word depression in the same sentence with dementia, again, I have to say that there are many people, including some clinicians, who will say, well, if that person is X age, they're just depressed, and that's just what happens. They're depressed, and they're going to be more depressed, and they're going to get older, and case closed.
Yes, and that's a shame when somebody with a medical degree would think such a thing. If you look at the depression and loneliness studies, younger people have higher rates of depression. The loneliest years of our lives are in the teens and in the 20s. And happiness surveys around the world, a majority of people over age 70 say they are as happy as they have ever been. And in the United States, there was a study that asked people over 65, what were the best years of your life? And a majority said, right now.
So again, you're really speaking to the importance, maybe even the urgency, of redefining how we think about ourselves and how we think about aging. We really need to think about what we as a society are doing to ourselves and others, and the myths that we take in, and in the way that we take them in, we actually make them true.
Absolutely. Yes, that's so very true. I think also, we mentioned a little bit ago about the power of changed thinking. It's important to get rid of some of these myths about old age. And it's important to understand that elderly person with dementia better in some ways that will be comforting. I remember going to visit my grandmother in a nursing home when I was in my late 20s, and I was so close to her. And I remember just really crying my heart out because she didn't know who I was, and she just wasn't who she had been. Well, I see that differently now. I see now that Granny was still there. And the research that I've done, I see that, yes, if you have dementia, you may lose 10 or 20 or 30 billion brain cells. But guess what? You still have 70 or 60 or 50 billion brain cells left there's still a person in there. And that elderly person can still respond to music, can still respond to smiles, can respond to touch, can respond to prayer or poetry or familiar scripture, sunshine, flowers. You can take a folding chair and sit outside and have a picnic with a sandwich and some potato chips. Elderly people, even with dementia, respond to gardens and patios and birds and sunsets. That person wants you to know, I'm still here. So even if I don't remember your name, even if I'm incontinent or I have these disabilities, you need to know that I will still receive those simple basic things because there's a lot of me left inside.
When you use the word depression in the same sentence with dementia, again, I have to say that there are many people, including some clinicians, who will say, well, if that person is X age, they're just depressed, and that's just what happens. They're depressed, and they're going to be more depressed, and they're going to get older, and case closed.
Yes, and that's a shame when somebody with a medical degree would think such a thing. If you look at the depression and loneliness studies, younger people have higher rates of depression. The loneliest years of our lives are in the teens and in the 20s. And happiness surveys around the world, a majority of people over age 70 say they are as happy as they have ever been. And in the United States, there was a study that asked people over 65, what were the best years of your life? And a majority said, right now.
So again, you're really speaking to the importance, maybe even the urgency, of redefining how we think about ourselves and how we think about aging. We really need to think about what we as a society are doing to ourselves and others, and the myths that we take in, and in the way that we take them in, we actually make them true.
So much is true, absolutely. One of my favorite studies that I came across looked at 69-year-olds who on a brain scan had healthy brains, and it followed those 69-year-olds to age 78. And during those years from 69 to 78, we would expect to see in normal brains some brain shrinkage. Well, they looked at people who walked an average of 30 minutes a day or 6 to 9 miles a week. And those folks grew gray matter in those 9 years when they would be expected to lose somewhat. So they cut their risk of dementia in half by walking 30 minutes a day. We can do a lot to take care of ourselves to reduce our risk of Alzheimer's. People think it's just about genetics. Well, genetics plays a role, but with later onset dementia, genetics is not the dominant role. Lifestyle matters, health factors matter, and can make a tremendous difference in reducing our risk factors.
One of the issues that you talk about in redefining aging, and it certainly comes up in the experience for some, if not many, is when you have the feeling that you must care for someone who has been abusive to you. What do you do in that situation?
Well, you have to be honest with yourself and self-evaluate. If we look at who are the family members most likely to abuse the elder person, the people most likely to be abusive are the people who were abused themselves. It is really important to be honest with oneself. If you were abused by that older person when you were growing up, or you carry a lot of anger and pain and resentment, you're probably not the one to be the caregiver. Not unless you go for help from a psychologist or social worker or other counselor or pastoral counselor, because you're at risk of abusing that person, and someone who doesn't carry those wounds needs to be the caregiver.
For those people who are hearing you but still feel tied to this concept that, well, that's my mom and I should take care of her, or that's my dad, and I really have to do this. You're saying be honest with yourself.
Well, and I think some people are big enough. My own sister was the one in our family who was mistreated. And to her everlasting credit, she was in the same town as my dad when he was in his 90s, and she took care of him. He was in an assisted living place where he got some professional care, and he didn't live with my sister, but my sister very faithfully and lovingly, she listened to her higher angels, and she was able to be a kind, caring daughter to a father who mistreated her in many ways as she was growing up. So it can be a challenge. It can be you can make yourself a better human being by standing up and finding the strength, maybe getting some professional help so that you can be a kind, giving, caring caregiver to the person who may have mistreated you.
So again, what you're saying is that it's really important to be honest with yourself as to whether or not you believe you are up to the task of caring for someone who you have experienced as having been abusive towards you as you were coming along. Folks, we are going to take a break. You have been listening to Dr. Anne Kaiser-Stearns, who is the author of Redefining Aging, A Caregiver's Guide to Living Your Best Life. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Dr. Kaiser-Stearns, you tell the story of Bella, a 77-year-old woman. Can you share that story with our audience?
So Bella had taken good care of herself throughout her life. She was physically active. She had lots of friends. She had meaningful work. But she did develop Alzheimer's disease. And it was hard for the family to know how to handle her, because she functioned so well in so many ways. But the telltale signs were she would get online. She was divorced and then remarried, and then her husband died. And after that, she would get online and meet these strange men. And sometimes she would fly, 200 miles to another city to meet somebody out of the blue. And the family was very worried about her safety because she wasn't showing good judgment. So they was a large family, and she had a loving brother who would, fly down to Florida and try to talk to his sister. And, it was quite a lot to manage. But they finally got her to promise that she would stop meeting these strange people, or at least meet somebody who was local and somebody she could meet at a coffee shop. And they told her she just had to stop sharing such personal information. So, those are signs that somebody is potentially going to get themselves into trouble, and the family needs to step up and be helpful.
In that kind of a situation where a family member is making very poor decisions but has not been declared incompetent, what really can caregivers do
to protect her?
Well, it's certainly a tough job, but there are some universal things that really can matter. First of all, it's important to continue to speak to persons in respectful, caring, kind ways. We have to remember that no adult wants to be talked to like a child. and we need to slow things down. We need to let certain things go that don't matter. For instance, if someone is saying, John will be home for dinner, he'll be here any minute, and she's talking about a husband or a son who died 20 years ago, fiblets are a good thing. You don't have to say, well, John's been dead for years, he's not coming. You can just say, you can just nod and say, I know it means so much to you to have John in your as a part of your life and in your heart. You can find ways to not have to tell the hard truth. You can do loving fibs. It's important to try to avoid getting to the place that where Bella got. More discussions needed to be happening with Bella and her loved ones before she developed the dementia so that she could be participant in those decisions. And even if somebody has Alzheimer's, they should be involved as to the greatest extent possible in discussions about, well, where can you live and what can we do to help you be sure to be safe. And usually, if you can work with a person before they get completely incapacitated cognitively, and if you can speak with them honestly and caringly and patiently and respectfully, oftentimes the elderly person will say, I know I'm too old to drive, or I know I need to be someplace where I don't have to cook for myself and I can be safe.
One of the things that I noticed about the conversations you described with Bella is that the family didn't say to her, you can't meet new people. So they didn't try to take that away from her. They simply tried to reposition it in a way that they could be more aware of her whereabouts and perhaps closer in order to be able to help her with safety. So that's a really interesting shift, I think, and a really interesting approach. You're not saying you're crazy, you're old, you're nuts, forget it. You're sort of taking the part that's important to them and couching it in a way that's more tolerable.
Absolutely. And the fact that you speak that way bespeaks your background and your training, Dr. Brewer. It's so important. We are trained as psychologists. It's so important how we treat people, and it's so important that we help work with people in ways that bring along their acceptance, bring along their cooperation, as opposed to treating people and bossing them around like they're children.
As you say, there are a lot of resources that you offer in redefining aging, and among the resources and among some of the issues that you address is the issue of identifying the resources that may in fact require legal documents. What are some of the legal documents that one may need to have in order to access resources for the...
We all need a will and or a living revocable trust. We all need a medical power of attorney so that our children or our other spouse or other loved ones know, in if I have a stroke and I have brain death, or it's impossible for them to bring me back to life in any kind of qualitative way, here's what I want you to be able to do. I don't want to be resuscitated, or I don't want a ventilating tube. Or I don't want to be force-fed. You can agree. You can sign those papers that give directives legally to your family and to the physicians. It's also important to have a power of attorney so that even if you don't develop Alzheimer's, but you have a stroke or you're in a car accident, one of your children or your spouse or others know where the legal documents are. They have the ability to write checks. They can pay the mortgage while you're incapacitated. They can pay medical bills. So those are the documents that are important. One of the things I also, though, would like to come back to, if you don't mind, is this business of skills. I think one of the things that's so exasperating for the caregiver is they just like are at a loss of like, what do I do? How do I handle this? And many of the resources out there are full of great ideas for dealing with tough situations, like when you're accused of stealing or when the person breaks out in tears and refuses to dress or take their medicine. It's so important to know that a lot of those resources are in good books and are in AARP magazine or are in the resources offered by the Alzheimer's Society. If we tap into those resources, we're empowered so that we're not just at a loss as how to handle these tough situations.
So let's take a look at one of the common experiences that happen during the process of caretaking, when the caregiver is accused of stealing something or hiding something from the individual, and the caregiver knows good and well that he or she hasn't stolen anything, hasn't done anything untoward, and in fact is doing everything possible to care for this person. How can they think about these experiences so that it's not taken personally by the caregiver?
Yes, it's terribly important, as you just mentioned, not to take it personally. Instead of defending ourselves of, well, of course I didn't steal your car, it's parked out in the parking lot, instead of saying that, we need to ask the person questions like, well, I'd like to say, who, what, where, when. Ask the person who's accusing you of stealing, like, who told you that, or what have I done that makes you think that, or where did you get that idea? When did that thought come into your mind? So that instead of just dismissing their concern or defending yourself, sort of explore that. Have them tell you where they got that idea, and then you can respond. You can say, oh, well, let me show you. Your car is still parked out in the parking lot. We haven't sold your car. But you have to say that you have to find out that your mother thought that you had taken the car because it wasn't parked where it used to be. So find out the information. Treat that person like somebody who can give you their thoughts about why they think you've stolen something or done something wrong.
So it sounds like you're suggesting that people use what is actually one of my favorite words, curiosity.
Wonderful. I love it. Uh-huh. You bet.
Be curious rather than judgmental. That gives you a lot more information and a lot more options.
Yes, and that's true of many things. For instance, when the person does something like wanders away or explodes in anger when getting dressed to go someplace, you can ask yourself questions like, well, what happened before that behavior occurred? And what happened after? What was the activator? And then what were the consequences? And then to think of two or three ways that the activator that made the thing happen and the consequence that was the result can be changed. It is very empowering. You know, my children are both adopted from India from when they were tiny little babies, one of them 5 pounds when she came at 2 months. And they're now young women, and I have a grandkid and all of that now. But I remember my social worker saying to me, well, what will I do? You know, I have one child and who's 3, and I'm going to have a new baby, and what if she has problems and comes with sicknesses? And the social worker said, when there are problems, you'll find solutions. And even though I was a psychologist with a doctor's degree, you know, I needed to hear that myself. Oh, right. If there are problems, there are solutions. So sometimes we just feel overwhelmed because we think things are hopeless, as opposed to saying, okay, what was it that happened? Why did this happen? What were the circumstances? And how can I change the circumstances? If he is getting up in the middle of the night and leaving the house, and I'm terrified because he's wandering out there, how can I disguise that door so that he doesn't see it as a door, where there's a curtain there instead of a door? Or how can I put the lock up higher? Or how can I get up when he goes to the bathroom at night and be sure that I help him back to bed, because that was when he got up and got out the door and ended up outside? So it's that business of saying, what are the problems, and let's think of how they came about and how I can change that.
So in other words, what you're saying is that in addition to using curiosity, it's also important to use creativity.
Oh, well said. Absolutely. So true. And the other thing is, you know, there can be too much of a good thing. Sometimes the caregiver is trying to be so conscientious and is such a loving daughter or son or spouse or sister or brother that they're trying like you must take this medicine. Well, a physician friend of mine said, you know, maybe the medicine doesn't have to be taken at breakfast when she's more likely to fight over taking the medicine. So ask the doctor, does the medicine have to be given there, or can I give the medicine later in the day when she's not having as much stress as she seems to have in the morning? And also, things like this, letting things go. So what if your dad, who is elderly, wears the same trousers for 5 days in a row? You can sneak in at night and wash them and put them back. It's just important to not be so caught up with, I've got to be a good caregiver. I can't let my dad wear the same trousers 5 days in a row or have food on his shirt. It's so important to say, I need to slow down, let things go. Because when I'm pushing, when I'm trying somebody to get dressed, or I'm trying to do something for somebody when we need to be in a hurry because we're going to the doctor's office or someplace else, slow things down, let things go. You don't have to be a perfect caregiver. And that takes pressure off the person, and they're less likely to respond in some kind of an outburst.
The caregiver and the person who's being cared for.
Absolutely. There are times of the day when we are more tired. There are times of the day when we are more stressed, and we need to not do things that are time-consuming and difficult with the elderly person we're caring for during those times. It's the same way when we're raising our children. You know, we have to choose when and where we do things. Because sometimes if we're trying to insist on somebody doing a certain thing when we are already rushed for time or stressed, it isn't going to go well.
You know, I'm reminded of challenges that a former client of mine had in securing a caregiver for her mom, and mother didn't want a caregiver. Mother only wanted my client, and for all kinds of reasons, that was going to be impossible, including the fact that my client had a full-time job. But when she would finally get a caregiver, inevitably, mother would say something that was way beyond the pale. And mother perhaps wouldn't even have said such a thing had she been more cognitively present. But those kinds of situations come up, and they're difficult. How does one deal with that? How does the caregiver deal with the hired assistant when the person being cared for is really misbehaving badly?
Well, for one thing, we have to apologize. There's a story in my book of a woman who didn't, you know, wasn't at all a racist person when she was well, but when she had dementia, she said some of the terrible things that are said in society, you know, and she was treating the African-American caregiver as if she was the servant as opposed to being the nursing aide. And basically, the daughter of that woman profusely apologized to the caregiver and eventually decided, you know, if my mother is going to treat black people that way, I can't let my mother be cared for by an African-American person because I don't want to subject that person to those kinds of words that are coming only because my mother has advanced Alzheimer's. And as a person who was religious and who had a good heart before that and who would just not have behaved that way. So we have to sort of intervene at times and apologize to caregivers at times and protect them. They need respect. When paid caregivers, whether in nursing homes or someone who comes in some hours a day and is a paid caregiver at your house, they work very hard. They aren't paid enough. They need our respect and profound gratitude, and they need us to intervene and be sure that they are being treated right.
So if you find that a person you are caring for is saying or behaving in ways that are unacceptable, then it is your obligation almost to yourself to share that information and to really look at what's acceptable to you in the dispensing of your services.
Absolutely. And I tell caregivers when I do workshops for nursing home folks and nurses and others in the helping professions, you are never required by your job to be the recipient ongoingly of something like racism or sexism or harassment. We do not ask that of you, and you should never accept it. So if you're mistreated in any way, it needs to be reported to the person who's employing you. It needs to be reported so that you are protected. Nobody should be required to stay in a situation where they're being abused. And by the way, when I was writing this book, I wanted to write for people of all religions, and I interviewed a rabbi, and we talked a lot about honor your father and mother, which is, you know, whether you're a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Christian or a Jewish person or a Muslim, honor your father and mother is a part of the great religions of the world. And the rabbi told me that it is in Scripture that if you are being abused by that parent, you are not obliged to continue to be that person's caregiver. You're not obliged to continue to put yourself in the company of that abuse to be receiving more abuse. And I thought, you know, that's a really wonderful thing to remember. We honor our parents, and we live by a high morality in terms of caregiving, but we're never required to be hurt ourselves and abused. We're never required to do that.
And just one sidebar to that before we take a quick break is that you have to be careful and you have to be clear about what your definition is of abuse. Your parents agreeing or disagreeing with you is not an example of abuse.
We're going to take a break.
Oh, and absolutely.
We'll come right back and perhaps talk a little bit more about that. Dr. Kaiser Stearns, I just wanted to give you an opportunity to say a little bit more about the comment I made just before the break regarding the need to be clear about one's definition of abuse. When folks are caregiving, particularly if they're caregiving a parent or a sibling, there can be some confusion around whether or not he or she agreeing or disagreeing with me is abusive, or it's simply he or she not doing what I tell them to do.
Absolutely. resistance is inevitable. Again, all you have to do is imagine ourselves getting old and being dependent on another person for practically everything, and even going to the bathroom, getting help with everything. It is so important to remember that the frustration that the elderly person feels with that dependency and all of the ordeal of the problems they're having with their dementia or other health problems. It's so important to know that when they complain or when they bark at us or say words that are unkind or accuse us of not caring, it's so important to know that, or they don't want to get dressed right now and they refuse to get dressed or don't want to take their medicine, that none of those things has anything to do with abuse. Those things come from the illness, and we need to be able to absorb them. Just as we have to be able to absorb, to have a decent marriage, you have to be able to absorb times when your spouse gets angry at you and barks at you for something, large or small. What we're talking about is any kind of sexually inappropriate behavior racist conversation or something that is really egregious in terms of harassment. But I do want to say something about sexual behavior, and that is that sometimes an older man might reach for his daughter in some kind of grasping way, not because he is a dirty old man who is being sexually improper, but because his daughter looks like his wife who has passed away. You know, his daughter looks like the wife he married long ago because of their resemblance. So you have to be careful to not just conclude something is a sexual violation. Another thing is so important to understand that older people, older adults, are sexual beings, and that is not a bad thing. I teach people who work in nursing homes, you know, you need to knock on people's doors. And somebody, there's not something wrong with a person if he is masturbating. There's not something wrong with him as long as he can give consent and she can give consent. If two of those people in the nursing home are in bed together or sort of making out together, when we all get old, we'll be glad that we're still sexual people and that we still find pleasure in those kinds of activities. But we have to be careful not to be judgmental and not to misunderstand. I'm just talking about terrible words that are racist, for instance. I don't think anybody should have to cope with that or suck it up and deal with that as a caregiver. Or be violated in any kind of sexual or harassing way.
One of the things that occurs to me is important for folks to really consider is that when you find yourself having a reaction to a person that you're caring for, rather than say to yourself, I shouldn't feel this way, it's much more useful to use curiosity and wonder why you're feeling that way. And that will help you to tease out what it is, in fact, that you're actually experiencing. Is this abuse? Is this something else? Is this the illness? What do I need to do about this for me?
I think that's a wonderful point. You bet. A thing that I have noticed as in my whole career as a psychologist, but also in raising children, it was so important for me to reach out to a friend. If I'm all baffled by something or I'm mad, I can't ever be angry at a student or a patient. I can't, if I'm angry at one of my children for doing something, I need to figure out, like, what's that about, just as you were saying. For me, I would call my best friend, and I would just sort of share what was going on. And it always helped me to just ventilate and to get that off my chest. And it always helped me to say, okay, what's going on? And I need to get back in control. I'm the mom here, or I'm the teacher here, or I'm the doctor here. It's my job to control my emotions.
You remind caregivers that it is important for them to get sufficient exercise and sufficient rest and sufficient meals. But I wonder how you match that up against the caregiver who may need to get up in the middle of the night to make sure that their loved one is getting the help that they need. So how do you orchestrate quality sleep for yourself in that kind of a situation?
Again, you can check with the resources in your community. One of the fellows I wrote about, his wife had Lou Gehrig's disease and was in the last several years extremely debilitated, and he was a wonderful caregiving husband. But he learned of resources, and I'm blanking right now on what where he got this help. And it might have been from the same people who provide respite at the end of life. But he got help in the form of once a month, somebody came in and did the caregiving for several days so he could have a vacation. He could literally be away. And that helped sustain him for the years, and it went on for 3 or 4 years of his role as an extensive caregiver with all of the bodily hygiene caregiving and all of the turning her over in bed and all of that. He needed to get respite. One of the things we were talking about earlier that I wanted to come back to had to do with people having a job. I found in the research that if you have a job, it's better to keep it. You might say to yourself, well, my mother needs full-time care. I need to go ahead and retire or leave my job and stay home. Well, we know that if you keep your job, it will help you because our jobs, besides doing work, we are getting contact with other people. We're getting a sense of self-esteem because I'm doing this job and I can do a job well and I have some sense of control in the things I do, unlike at home with my mother's increasing dementia where I don't have that kind of control on making her better. So it's a good idea if you have a job to keep your job. We all, and that's a form of respite as well. Going back to exercise, it is so important. Exercise is the fountain of youth. Exercise, again, remembering that if I walk 30 minutes a day, I can just about reduce my risk of Alzheimer's in half just from staying physically fit. And there's nothing for me and for most people better as a stress buffer than exercise.
And that's something that doesn't necessarily require a doctor's prescription or a pill.
Right. And if it's winter, you can walk around, your house many times. You can set a timer and walk around your house. You can go up and down the basement steps. You can lift weights at home. They ask, like, what's the best exercise? Well, it's whatever you'll keep doing. So exercise is very important to our own mental health and to reducing the stress we feel.
When the person being cared for passes away, the caregiver can have lots of very different and sometimes difficult and conflicting emotions. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Of course. So oftentimes the person feels guilty because the first response they have is relief. Well, you have to be kind to yourself and say, you probably wouldn't want to still be alive if you were as ill and frail as your loved one was. And it's okay that you feel relief for them. It's also human and okay that you feel relief for yourself because you have been under terrible stress. You have probably not been the grandmother you'd have been otherwise or the mother you'd have been otherwise to your other loved ones or the wife or husband. You probably haven't been taking care of yourself the way you need to. And so, of course, there's a sense of relief of finally, I don't have this responsibility that is such a heavy responsibility. So people need to be forgiving of themselves and understanding that all of those feelings are normal. It's normal to feel relief. It's normal to have felt resentful at times for having to be the caregiver or other people not helping you enough. Just to accept being human is really important.
And to the family of the person who's providing the care, any wisdom you'd like to share with the family members of the caregiver?
Yes, it is so important to explain to the granddaughter who says, well, I don't want to go see grandmother. It makes me sad. Or I don't want to see grandmother. She won't even remember later. It's important to know that, yes, she will receive that caring. And the granddaughter does need to go because she'll feel guilty when grandmother dies. She'll say to herself, I wish I had done more. I feel bad that I didn't get more love. The other thing is, explain to the granddaughter that grandmother is there. She may not remember your name. She may mix you up with somebody else, but she knows you. She knows your smile. She knows your touch. She will take in the warmth you give her from that hug. She'll take in the warmth you give her if you go over with the puppy to pet or you take her some flowers or some chocolate. She will receive that. And it goes into her heart. I use this as an example. I have a grandbaby, my first, who is not quite 4 months old. We all love her to pieces, and at Thanksgiving, everybody was loving on her, and we're all hugging and talking and singing and playing. She will not remember any of this. She will not remember the whole first 3 years of her life when she gets all of this love, but the love is in her heart forever. And so it is with the elderly person with Alzheimer's or multiple strokes. That person who you may think won't remember this or won't receive it, and it doesn't matter if you go see her, she will receive it. She'll receive it as surely as my grandbaby receives the love we give her. It'll be in her heart. It'll be there forever. It will lift her spirits.
That is such an important piece for folks to recognize and to really hold on to, because there are times when that will really be hard to do.
Yes, I like the idea of be like the sun. All we need to do is give warmth. Another thing I like is the Dalai Lama has a quote, whenever possible, be kind. It is always possible. Warmth and kindness, showing respect, treating the elderly person with respect. I used to be angry when a 30-year-old doctor would call my mother Margaret, you know, and I would say, call her Mrs. Kaiser. I wanted my elderly mom to be spoken to with respect. And we need to do that. Kindness, warmth, respect. Those things are powerful. We take them in no matter how old we are. And other things like music and familiar readings. Those things, along with facial expressions that are positive, all of those things are received by a person, even if they are very advanced with something like Alzheimer's.
The idea that you can continue to give and it will be received is such an important reminder. And I do thank you for impressing that upon our listeners. There's so much that you offer in redefining ages. There's so much that you offer in redefining aging. Where can folks go to get more information about you and about what you're doing?
Yes, here's my website, annkaiserstearns.com, AnnKaiserstearns.com. My book is available at Amazon, and I think it will help a lot of people.
Well, I'm convinced that the work that you've done and the work that you continue to do will help many regardless of their age. So thank you so much, Dr. Ann Kaiser Stearns, for joining us today on Mind Talk. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical or mental health or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to today's edition of Mind Talk. So do send an email to pamela@mindtalk.org. That's pamela@mindtalk.org. And you can always listen to Mind Talk on demand by going to the Mind Talk website. Again, that's mindtalk.org, or you can download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes or Google Play Store. And remember, always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.